I started hearing stories about my father's work and the lives that he saved and the things that he did, and that was positive and empowering. So that's it. Mm-hmm.
So I am child number 363 of the Santo Tilian list. And that revelation was one of the more important moments in my life. Actually, I know that I am a Santo Tilian child number 363 for about, I think, 2 or 3 months. And before that, the knowledge about the history of my family was a little bit vague. It developed over the years, as you correctly mentioned. There was a very long period of silence and of not talking to the second generation, me, of what happened, what was the history of the family, and so on. My father died without saying anything about the war period and the afterwar years. And my mother, who lived a long life, she passed away a year and a half ago, did record her memoirs at a later stage of her life, after 40 years, and so we have a record of that. What did I found from her memoirs, and what did I found from what what I could find from them? Yes. So this is my mother, and the beautiful baby there is me. Yes. And yes. And this is again my mother. In the room, and you can see the very modest situation of that room, but I will in a moment say something about my mother and Santo Tilian. Do we have more? Yes, and again, my mother on the left with me. If any of you recognizes the woman on the right, because we try to locate her name, we do not know. And there's another figure. That's the last one. Okay, so I'll say something about it. I'll say something. Can you put the one figure back? One back, yes. You can see my mother is on the left. You can see that she's healthy, she's happy, she looks at me with great love. And one of the main revelations that I had when starting to live into that period, which is only the past year, looking again at pictures and at reading again the chapter of my mother, was that that period, and that was a major surprise to me, and I think that we shall hear confirmation of that, is the years immediately after the Holocaust were years of great enthusiasm, great vivaciousness, a lot of optimism, a lot of happiness. The pictures of my parents from these 2 years in Munich, pictures which show a young couple that begins its life and does not want to sink into the horrors of the Holocaust, into the knowledge that that the family was totally destroyed. And to be very open with you, I think that in later years, I never saw a picture of my father so happy as in the pictures of his Santo Tilian and Munich period. This is a great surprise, a great revelation for me, which I still do not understand. But maybe it is linked also to the to what you said, which is common to very many families, and that is that our parents did not talk at all. And there are many reasons of why they did not talk. They wanted to protect us. They wanted to focus on building new life and new careers. There was a undercurrent, an unpleasant undercurrent in Israel about the immigrants that survived the Holocaust, which I can summarize only in one line. Why didn't you fight? The whole concept, the whole idea of the birth of the State of Israel is that here the Jews have eventually an army. They are strong, they can protect themselves, they can fight, they do fight. They achieved the State of Israel through... and here comes a huge influx of immigrants. And there was a question of the in the air, why didn't you fight? Why did you... I don't know how to say it in English, I'll say it in Hebrew, for those of you who know the language. Tzon muvad
ha-tevach.
Thank you. And I think that the vivaciousness that I saw in the pictures of immediately after the Second World War and the fact that they wanted to protect us is the reason that in the first years they did not speak at all. Even during the Eichmann trial, which brought the whole period into the into highlight, my parents simply did not speak about it, did not talk about it at all. What happened after 40 or 50 years when they started to open their mouths? First of all, the feeling of the need to protect us, to protect me, was no longer relevant. Israel is a strong state with a strong army, with a high-level science, and the feeling of protectiveness is not necessarily relevant anymore. Secondly, they skipped a generation. They did not speak with us. They spoke with the grandchildren. The grandchildren started to ask questions. And in response to the questions of the grandchildren, for instance, the education system in Israel is such that there is a project which is called Roots. You have to make a work on what are the roots of your family and what the family has done. So they started to ask questions. And also, towards the end of one's life, when one reflects backwards, then what was important in life and what was less important in life gets the right proportion. My mother, at the end of in the last decade, spoke practically when she recalled her memory, nothing from Israel, only the period of the Second World War and the staying in... And staying in Santo Tilly. In brief, what I learned from these memoirs and from the later talks is my mother is from Warsaw, my father is from a small village on the border of Ukraine and Poland, and both of them fled their town already after the invasion. My mother left Warsaw late in 1939. My father also left his village at about that time. And they fled to Russia. And they spent their years in Russia. My mother was in Siberia and in Tashkent. And it's amazing for me to find many children from that period that describe the same route of motion. My father spent his years mainly in the Ural Mountains in Russia, and of course, knowledge about what is going on in the concentration camps started to dissipate slowly. My father wrote poetry, and his poetry from his years in the Ural Mountains is extremely dark, so dark that I decided not even to bring you an example. But then when the war ended, there was a mass movement of millions of people from the east to the west, not only Jews, but this is one of the chapters in history in which huge numbers of people started to move and to relocate and to go back. And the route, roughly, was from Russia to Poland, from Poland to Czechia, the Czech Republic, from there to Austria, to Salzburg, from Salzburg to Germany. And the reason why Germany was the last station is that my father joined an organization which in Hebrew is called Pechach, partisans, soldiers, Chayalim, soldiers.
Yes.
Partisans, soldiers, pioneers. And because he knew very well Yiddish and knew very well Hebrew, he studied for many years, and he was a man of writings, a scholar, he was asked to be the editor-in-chief of that journal. And the base of that organization was in Munich, and I brought today to the conference the volume of the of what he edited. So they ended here in Munich. Marriage at that time was not an issue. They simply went to the local municipality and declared they are married. And actually the official marriage was only in 1956 in Israel. And when my mother became pregnant, they did some shopping around where is the best place to have me. And they decided that Santo Tilin is the best place. The reputation of that place was well developed at that time, and that is how my mother ended here in Santo Tilio. I will just end this section of my description by saying something which also is not trivial. My mother describes the month in Santo Tilio as one of her best periods in life. That is that was the first time, after 6 years of all kind of difficulties of being a refugee, of being hungry, of freezing at night, of not knowing where to wash your clothes in the evening, of not having medicine, suddenly in a situation that everybody is taking care of you, and you do not have to take care of anything else. That is why she looks so relaxed in this pictures. And so that is also something which is not trivial. You are in a country that was responsible to one of the most horrific chapters in the history of humankind, and that is the place where you feel happy, relaxed, with a lot of energies to move into the future. I have a lot more to say, but I think that at this stage I will stop. And
thank you so much. I'd like to turn over the floor to Eli, and I think we will see the PowerPoint presentation you prepared. So I will.
Oh, okay. So you all recognize this place. It's this is a photograph that was taken by Tuval, our son. On a visit, and we've been visiting Santo Tilin for some time now. It's a picture in the evening, and I think it captures one of the feelings that I have about this place. I'm going to have to tell you when to move on, because it's animated, and I'll tell you about that. I think it captures the feeling that I've developed about St. Julian over time. When first coming to Germany many years ago, there were many places that I felt very uncomfortable. for obvious reasons. And yet, this was a place where I was always made to feel comfortable each time I came. And so I think this captures a time of peace in the evening and reflects the way that, that I certainly feel about Centre Tuning. Now, this again is a personal story. You're going to hear more about my and the family's interaction with Centre Tuning, post-Centre Tuning, but I'll get into that now. If you go forward. And again. Okay. So this is a cover of a book that those of you who work in the field probably should recognize by Sir Evan Mankiewicz, who worked at Leeds University and wrote about this period. And the title, I think, reflects very much of what we've been talking about today and yesterday. This was a period of life between memory and hope, and it's about the survivors of Holocaust. So he wrote about Shirita Pleta, and unfortunately, I have the feeling that had he still been alive, he would have been here at this conference, and I wanted to recognize his work by showing this picture. But there's another aspect to Zev Mankiewicz, because he was a friend, in fact. Can you hit the next piece, please? And this is when I knew him. Zev Mankiewicz came from South Africa, which is where we landed up after leaving Centre Tuning. And there was a period of time when he was known as Wolfida, which translates into Zev when he came to Israel. And he was a very important influence in my life, in my wife's life as well at the time. And it was a period of like 4 or 5 years when, in my late teenage years and his early 20s perhaps, we got to know each other very well. And yet, there was one thing that he didn't know about me when he came to the Hebrew University and started writing this book, and that was that I was one of the people in my family, was a family that he was actually writing about in his academic scholarship. This only became evident much later, and the reason for that is because we didn't talk about it. And the reason that we didn't talk about it is what you've already heard from many of you, from many of the people that have spoken today. There was silence. So in a situation of where there is silence and yet there's a heavy cloud that children understand, it's impossible not to understand that there's something in the background. What do you do as a kid? You look for symbols. And there was very little that they brought out of the, certainly before the camps, nothing. What happened to them before, my mother will talk about in a few minutes in a video that Moshe will show. So I won't get into that. But so there was this darkness. So what do we look for? There weren't very many symbols around. There was a tiny little shirt that one or both of us wore when we were here. There was a towel which was served as a baby blanket for me when they were traveling with me right after I was born on the trains that were crisscrossing Europe at the time on the way to Centre Tuning. So I arrived here 1, 2, or 3 weeks old. So technically I'm not one of the Centre Tuning children that Moshe is. So there was, however, a symbol that we did fasten onto as kids. It was a book, which I understand, because I think we are the only ones who have this, that my father, who was of the Zalman Greener, helped to run Centre Tuning, who was a physician, created, I think, in order to generate funds from America, because there was some wording inside that was written in English. It's a very simple booklet. The spine is made of wood, and you can see it's survived the 70 years, but not as careful as I've been, not all that well. And the front is the picture that you have seen in the back. Next slide. I think that it shows deliberately as the Gortzart Timer, where any number of you were born, and I think it's pretty clear that they chose the obstetrics department to show on the cover of this book, because it was symbolic of the meaning of renewal and survival. The pictures inside this, it was all pictures, it was just a picture book made out of cardboard, in fairly primitive fashion. Now, many of the pictures that are in the exhibition, when Moshe and I arrived here for the first time about 21 years ago, they didn't have any of these pictures, and some of the pictures that exist now in the inventory and the archives here are the pictures were from this book that we brought along with us, and the photographs were taken at the time. Next one. So this is a picture of my father in his white coat, and you see the pen that he is using. Very symbolic. It was a pen that was used. For Moshe, that was another symbol that we carried with us at the time. So the irony is that this young man of 30 years, along with Zalman Greenberg, who was a friend from Kovno, and they graduated at that same time, although Zalman graduated in from Basel, was running a hospital in his early 30s. The irony of it is that when we arrived in South Africa, his degree from the University of Kovno, cum laude, was not accepted. And he had to go back to medical school again. So we've gotten some new information that in fact we didn't know about, that my father was involved in some of the talks today. And that's been extremely helpful at this point. I really need to say that this has been amazing. I really want to thank the organizers, not only for putting this all together, but also giving me the opportunity to come and talk a little bit about this. Thanks. So we just heard from David what happiness can look like in a setting like this. And this is the four of us at that particular period of time. In St. Tertullian, probably sometime about 1947, based on the age of what those kids look like. I'm on the right, and Moshe is on the left, and everybody does look happy. Just to make a point that Bert Rochelson made earlier. So you see here four doctors, with five medical schools, as I just pointed out. The next one, please. So I'm a visual person, and I was trying to sort of figure out for myself how to represent what's going on here today before we came. And this is meant to be an hourglass, it's Central and Eastern Europe up at the top, and the whole world at the bottom, which is where everybody was scattered to today. It's the path that all of us have taken through St. Tertullian, a very small place in respect to the rest of the world. We started out in Kovno. I can say that I started there too, since my mother was very pregnant with me. We spent time in St. Tertullian, and then we scattered to all parts of the world. And David and I were just talking a minute ago while we were up here, and I think this coming together, this idea of all of us coming together, it has really been quite amazing. It's put us right in the middle of that Sandra Teeling picture there. And I think it also reflects, in some sense, a prism in which you scatter light to every different part of the world, although mainly to Palestine and Israel. But it also makes it difficult to look further back. And in a sense, I think what St. Tertullian has become, speaking for myself, is an opportunity to go back to a point which is positive. When you look at the pictures of the four of us, it was still positive. Going back further than that was a black hole. My parents never spoke about it, or spoke about it very little. Later, my mother, as we just heard, began to talk some. But really, she couldn't go back far enough. About 12 and a half years after we arrived in South Africa, my father was killed in a motor vehicle accident, and that sort of shut down everything. She was no longer able to talk about him, or when we talk. And so the last slide takes us a few steps of what the symbol of sensitivity and the return journey, I'm calling it, how we came back to sensitivity. So, first of all, we have here Oren, who is sitting here in the front row. Oren came to do a journey abroad in Prague, and he took it upon himself, nothing that I ever said to him. This was important enough to him, he'd seen the book as well, to try and find Sandra Teeling. This was not internet days, mind you. Today you could find this place in 5 seconds. And he took him two journeys into Germany, and I think he acquired a German-speaking girlfriend just for that purpose, and actually found Sandra Teeling. So that allowed Moshe and I to come, and that was at the bottom left, you see that picture. Later on, I met with Maya in Vilna and Kovna, and then we came as well. And that's a very much younger Father Cyril, in case anybody doesn't. And he has made us feel extremely comfortable about coming back here all these years, and I really want to thank him publicly for that. And our final visit went to Father Kavalov as well. So that's our brief journey that I wanted to share with you, and our attachment to Saint Tim and some issues on memory and symbolism.
Thank you so much, Lee. Moshe, you have put together a film of your mother when she was 94. She is speaking about her experiences prior to coming to Zangozien, and I would like to show you the film.
So just before you show the film, just give me 30 seconds. The film was made when my mother was 94. She spent 2 years here in St. Atelier with my father, who's the chief physician. And the picture, the video reflects her incredible enthusiasm for life, despite what she had been through, what many other Jews had been through in previous years. There are three times that she was saved by non-Jews. The first time they were hidden in a cellar, taken out of the Kovno ghetto, so they didn't go by the Dachau route. The second time was a gentleman who took them through the forest when the Soviets liberated Lithuania. And we videotaped this visit with this gentleman, and the important part of it is he starts to cry. He's 93, you'll see. And why I wanted to bring that out in particular is because it's very rare in life that you do these courageous things as non-Jews to save other people, but you don't see the fruits of your bravery. And when he sees me, he starts to cry. And then the third time is Saint Atelier. And I think that you've heard a lot about what it felt like to be here, and I think that the Saint Atelier monks and what this represented is also one of these elements of non-Jews looking after Jews. I'll let my mother tell the story.